In the late afternoon of March 16, 2021, the first emergency call from a small spa in Cherokee County reached dispatch. The report described gunfire, injured workers, and a fleeing suspect. Within minutes, investigators realized the scene did not stand alone. A second spa in Atlanta issued a similar call, then a third. What began as a single violent incident rapidly formed a coordinated pattern of movement across two counties. Each location marked by sudden harm and the deaths of workers who had little protection in their daily labor. By nightfall, 8 people were confirmed dead. 6 were women of Asian descent. The unfolding investigation forced national attention onto long-standing tensions surrounding race, gender, and the vulnerability of immigrant service workers. As law enforcement raced to understand the attacker's path, the central question emerged with growing urgency. What constellation of motives shaped these linked acts of violence? Chapter 1, The Sequence Begins. The first emergency call reached Cherokee County authorities at 4:50 p.m. on March 16, 2021. The caller reported gunfire inside a small spa off Highway 92. Her voice carried panic as she tried to describe injured workers, scattered customers, and a man seen leaving moments earlier. The details were incomplete, but the urgency was unmistakable. Dispatchers sent patrol units and medical responders. They had no reason to expect more than one isolated shooting. Large counties receive calls like this with painful regularity, and the first assumption is always containment. One scene, one crisis, one immediate danger to manage. When the first responders entered the spa, they encountered a quiet interior that bore signs of sudden violence. 2 victims appeared beyond help. A third showed no response when assessed. The rapid sequence of gunfire had given little chance for escape. The small rooms and narrow hallways created a sense of constriction. Officers noted overturned stools and scattered personal belongings. It was clear that the attack had unfolded quickly and without negotiation. The shooter had moved through the space with a direct path, targeting individuals without an apparent exchange of words. Within minutes, the responding officers secured the site and began a protective sweep to confirm that no one else was hiding, injured, or armed. The stillness inside contrasted sharply with the rising tension outside. Customers in nearby businesses stepped into parking lots, confused by the arrival of emergency vehicles. No one yet understood what had occurred beyond the fact of sudden harm. Law enforcement called for crime scene specialists and began the process of cordoning off the building. Protocol required them to treat it as a closed environment until all evidence could be documented. As officers gathered initial observations, investigators attempted to reconstruct the approximate time of the shooting. The earliest confirmed moment came from a timestamp on a customer's departing security camera. It placed the likely window of the gunfire between 4:45 and 4:50 p.m. Other businesses along the road reported seeing a vehicle leaving the area at high speed, though the descriptions varied. Some witnesses noted a dark sedan. Others remembered only that a driver appeared hurried. These details formed the first fragments of a timeline that investigators would later analyze in greater depth. At this stage, no one anticipated that more scenes would emerge. The assumption remained that this was a singular incident. Officers directed their attention to securing the perimeter, comforting surviving workers, and gathering early statements. Surviving employees spoke softly, in short and fragmented sentences, describing a man who moved with purpose. His expression, they recalled, was fixed. He did not announce a motive. He did not ask questions. He acted and left. The Cherokee County Command Center communicated the situation to regional agencies, though the message at that hour was routine. An active homicide scene, suspect at large, details forthcoming. About 30 minutes later, alerts reached Atlanta authorities from a spa in the northeast side of the city. A caller at that location reported gunfire. She said that 2 people appeared badly injured. The call sounded strikingly similar to the Cherokee County report. Almost immediately after that, a third Atlanta spa placed a call with nearly identical information. 3 locations, each within less than an hour, each describing sudden violence. This shifted the nature of the developing emergency. The scale was no longer local. It had become a regional threat in real time. Atlanta officers arrived at the second location at approximately 5:40 p.m. They entered a spa that provided routine wellness services to customers from the surrounding community. Again, the environment inside bore signs of rapid, targeted harm. Workers attempted to give directions to the most urgent victims. Officers quickly designated an emergency triage area. The similarities to the Cherokee County scene were impossible to ignore. Victims were found in compact rooms used for customer services. Items had been dropped mid-task. There were no signs of prolonged confrontation. Everything pointed to a pattern of quick entry, immediate firing, and fast departure. The third location reported its call roughly 15 minutes later. Officers who arrived at that spa observed another cluster of victims and employees in distress. They also noted that the building's layout matched the type of interior found at the previous two locations. The common features suggested that the perpetrator chose his targets deliberately. The sequence formed a clear trajectory that required urgent coordination across county lines. Dispatchers worked to pool incoming data and to create a shared operational picture that would allow officers to track potential routes leading away from each site. Law enforcement agencies in both counties understood that the situation had escalated beyond the capacity of any single department. Supervisors opened interagency communication channels to coordinate units and share identifying information. They reviewed surveillance footage from surrounding businesses. They sought eyewitness accounts from individuals who had been near the entrances of the spas. They examined roads linking the three sites to determine possible travel paths. While officers managed the scenes, analysts began examining time gaps between the shootings. The rough intervals, though still fluid at this stage, indicated that the same individual could feasibly have moved between all three locations. Meanwhile, community residents followed the developing situation with increasing concern. Messages began circulating on local phone apps, followed by early media alerts that reported multiple shootings in different parts of the metro area. The public lacked clarity, which contributed to rising anxiety. Some residents believed the incidents were unrelated. Others speculated that a coordinated threat existed. Parents contacted schools. Business owners locked their doors. Early information was limited, and official updates followed the standard cautionary approach: confirm only what is verified. This left many to piece together the unfolding story from scattered, incomplete posts. At the Cherokee County scene, crime scene specialists began documenting physical evidence. They photographed each room, recorded the sequence of footprints, and collected shell casings that lay on the ground. The arrangement of evidence suggested that the shooter had moved along a consistent directional path. Officers noted that the victims appeared to have been shot at close proximity. They also observed that none of the rooms showed evidence of forced entry. This meant the shooter entered through the front without resistance. The spa's small size made it difficult for workers to respond once the attack began. Back in Atlanta, officers at the second and third scenes reported similar findings. Shell casings were found near doorways and next to treatment rooms. Personal belongings such as phones, wallets, and identification cards were scattered on the floors. Several small tables were knocked over. The interior spaces were quiet except for the sounds of medical responders assisting surviving victims. Workers sat on the floor or leaned against walls, trying to process what had occurred. Officers moved carefully to avoid disturbing evidence, marking items with numbered indicators and recording notes for later forensic review. Investigators from both jurisdictions recognized that the coordination of evidence across three scenes would require careful sequencing. Each scene had its own set of witnesses, employees, and physical indicators. Timelines needed alignment. Vehicle descriptions required verification. The process was methodical and time-consuming, but it was essential to understand the sequence of events. Law enforcement understood that identifying the suspect as rapidly as possible was the priority. They began reconstructing approximate timestamps for each shooting in order to confirm whether the sequences matched one another with sufficient precision. During this stage, officers interviewed individuals who had been near the spas before or after the shootings. One witness in Atlanta reported seeing a lone male exit a spa quickly and drive away in a dark vehicle. She could not identify the license plate, but she remembered the direction he traveled. Another stated that he observed someone leaving the spa in what appeared to be a hurried manner, though he was uncertain whether the individual was connected to the violence. These early statements provided threads that investigators would later weave together with digital evidence. Within hours, law enforcement held a preliminary press briefing. Officials confirmed multiple fatalities across multiple locations. They declined to comment on the suspected relationship between the scenes, but they acknowledged similarities. The spokesperson urged the public to stay indoors if possible and to remain alert. Reporters pressed for information on victims, motive, and suspect identification. Authorities withheld these details to maintain investigative integrity. The press conference, though brief, confirmed to the public that the events were connected. The announcement heightened national attention. News outlets began broadcasting updates continuously, framing the events as a rapidly developing tragedy. Behind the scenes, supervisors expanded the investigative scope. They requested additional units, including state-level support. Highway patrol officers were instructed to watch for vehicles matching early descriptions. Traffic cameras along major corridors were reviewed for anomalies. These efforts were coordinated to contain potential movement of the suspect, though the exact direction remained unclear at that hour. Investigators also considered whether the perpetrator might attempt another location. This possibility created pressure to accelerate the timeline reconstruction. At the same time, medical examiners and emergency physicians at nearby hospitals began recording their own observations. The injuries they observed were consistent with close-range gunfire. Victims arrived in critical condition, and medical teams worked rapidly, though several were declared deceased soon after arrival. The clinical notes taken during this period would later contribute to the overall forensic picture, but in the immediate moment, the focus remained on treatment and stabilization. As the evening progressed, officers reviewed footage from businesses near each spa. One hardware store provided grainy footage that captured a vehicle arriving and departing within the time frame of the shooting. Though the footage lacked clarity, the general profile of the vehicle assisted investigators in narrowing their search. Other businesses contributed still images that captured partial angles of the same or similar vehicle. These various images formed the basis of a statewide lookout advisory. Officers used this information to refine their strategy. The coordination effort expanded again as analysts compiled data from multiple units. They overlaid travel times between the three spas. They matched call logs with estimated departure and arrival windows. They noted that each location was situated along a route that could be driven without significant delay. The time intervals supported the hypothesis that a single individual traveling by car had carried out all three attacks. This alignment placed additional urgency on apprehending the suspect before he could flee the region. Community members began arriving near the scenes, seeking information about their loved ones. Officers established designated areas for families. They provided updates when possible, though many details remained unconfirmed. The emotional toll on families and coworkers was immediate. Many workers in these spas were part of immigrant communities that had built networks around shared labor and experiences. The sudden loss of colleagues created shock and grief, compounded by the lack of clarity from officials. Support organizations began mobilizing to assist families with translation, communication, and crisis resources. By nightfall, the number of confirmed fatalities reached 8. Officers communicated this update with solemn urgency during a second press briefing. They emphasized that the investigation was ongoing and that all available resources were being deployed to identify the perpetrator. Reporters continued asking questions about motive, but officials stated that it was too early to speculate. They also declined to release victim names until families could be contacted. The controlled dissemination of information followed established protocol, but it left the public searching for answers. Investigators in both counties continued their evidence review late into the evening. They collected DNA samples from the scenes, though these would take time to process. They also analyzed shell casings to determine whether the same firearm had been used. Though preliminary assessments suggested a match, official confirmation required lab testing. This process would become a core part of the investigative effort in Chapter 2, But Chapter 1 closed with the understanding that law enforcement saw unmistakable alignment between the scenes. The coordinated events of March 16th presented more than a logistical challenge. They forced immediate confrontation with the possibility that the shootings were intentional and sequential. The repeated targeting of spas with largely Asian and Asian American workers raised concerns that extended beyond the immediate evidentiary questions. Officials acknowledged these concerns indirectly through careful statements. They recognized the gravity of the situation, yet they refrained from characterizing the events until further evidence could be reviewed. As midnight approached, investigators continued their search for the suspect's vehicle. Officers across multiple counties remained on alert. Crime scene teams completed their initial documentation, though extended analysis would follow in the days ahead. Supervisors consolidated early findings into a provisional timeline that suggested a focused and premeditated sequence. The public remained on edge, awaiting further information. The question that now framed the unfolding crisis drew closer to the center of national attention. Why had the attacker moved across three locations in under an hour, and what combination of motive, opportunity, and ideology had shaped this rapid progression of violence? This question would guide the next phase of the investigation. Chapter 2, Profiles, Evidence, and the Investigative Turn. The early morning of March 17, 2021, arrived with a heavy stillness across both Cherokee and Fulton counties. Investigators returned to their respective command centers to begin the next stage of their work. The immediate emergency had passed, but the larger task was beginning. Reconstruct the lives of the victims, identify the significance of the chosen locations, and sort through competing narratives of motive. In forensic practice, this phase demands precision, patience, and a commitment to the factual record. Officers, analysts, and medical examiners prepared for a day that promised to be both technically demanding and emotionally burdensome. The eight victims represented a cross-section of experiences shaped by migration, labor, gender, and cultural identity. Six were women of Asian descent whose lives reflected the economic and social trajectories of immigrant communities across the United States. Many worked at spas that offered routine wellness services to local clients. Their work was ordinary and physically demanding. It provided steady income, but carried with it vulnerabilities related to public perception, labor precarity, and the racialized stereotypes historically attached to Asian women in service industries. Two other victims, a customer and a worker not of Asian descent, underscored that the violence did not follow a strictly uniform demographic line, though experts would later note that gendered and racialized patterns remained central to the overall event. Investigators contacted families to gather biographical details. These conversations were somber and often conducted through interpreters. Families described the victims as dedicated workers, caretakers, parents, and community members. Some had immigrated years earlier to support family members abroad. Others had settled in Georgia after relocating from different parts of the United States. Their lives illustrated the diverse and multi-layered realities of immigrant labor in metropolitan regions. The investigators' notes from these interviews would later contribute to public understanding of the victims as individuals beyond the statistical category of victims of a mass shooting. While victim profiles were being assembled, analysts reviewed the available evidence from the three crime scenes. Surveillance footage formed the core of the early investigative leads. The footage from a hardware store near the first spa captured a dark vehicle arriving shortly before the shooting and departing immediately afterward. Though the image quality was limited, investigators believed it belonged to the suspect. Additional footage from Atlanta businesses captured partial glimpses of a similar vehicle. These fragments supported the theory that one individual had moved between all three locations. The task now was to identify the driver. Witness statements continued to be processed. Several witnesses described a man entering one of the spas earlier in the afternoon. His behavior did not draw attention at the time, but in retrospect, the witnesses recalled that he moved quickly and with minimal interaction. Another witness reported seeing a man leave in a hurried state, though she could not provide details beyond general height and clothing color. Investigators compared the witness accounts across the three locations. The descriptions, while not identical, shared enough common features to support the assumption of a single perpetrator. The next break came from an examination of traffic cameras along the corridor between the spas. Analysts reviewing footage located a sequence of images that showed a vehicle matching earlier descriptions traveling southbound shortly after the Cherokee County shooting. Later images captured what appeared to be the same vehicle traveling east toward Atlanta. The timestamps aligned closely with the estimated travels derived from the reconstructed timeline. This confirmation allowed investigators to issue an operational advisory containing the vehicle model, color, and provisional license plate information. Within hours, law enforcement located a vehicle that matched the advisory. Highway patrol officers conducted a brief pursuit but apprehended the driver without incident. The driver was a 21-year-old male who matched witness descriptions. Officers transported him to a regional facility for questioning. The arrest provided a turning point in the investigation. The focus now shifted from identifying the suspect to understanding his rationale. During the initial interview, the suspect made statements that framed the shootings as a response to what he described as a personal struggle with temptation. He claimed that the spas represented places he sought to avoid due to what he portrayed as an addiction. Investigators documented these statements carefully, marking them as allegations rather than verified motive. They did not accept the suspect's framing at face value. Instead, they compared his statements with the factual record, including location patterns, victim demographics, and the nature of the violence. The suspect's claims sparked immediate national attention once released. The idea that the shootings were prompted by the suspect's personal struggle provoked public debate. Scholars, community advocates, and civil rights organizations raised concerns that such framing risked erasing the racial and gender dynamics inherent in the attack. They argued that the suspect's narrative was deeply intertwined with long-standing stereotypes about Asian women and the cultural meanings historically attached to spas and massage businesses in the United States. These perspectives informed the public discourse surrounding the investigation and influenced how journalists and academics contextualized the event. At the investigative level, officers continued to gather and cross-reference evidence. They analyzed shell casings from the three locations and submitted them for ballistic testing. Early results noted consistent markings that suggested the use of the same firearm. Additional forensic assessments examined the arrangement of casings and bullet trajectories to reconstruct the shooter's path inside each building. These analyses indicated that the shooter moved quickly and targeted individuals at close range. The consistency of the patterns across the three spas reinforced the conclusion that the attacks were premeditated and followed a deliberate route. Digital forensics teams reviewed the suspect's electronic devices, including his mobile phone. They examined communications, search histories, and location data. While the findings are not detailed in this chapter due to narrative boundaries, it is relevant that investigators sought to understand whether the suspect had researched the spas beforehand. They also assessed whether he had expressed intentions to others or acted without prior communication. These assessments aimed to determine the degree of planning involved and whether the suspect acted alone, though early evidence suggested that he did. Parallel to the forensic work, the victim profiles continued to expand. Scholars working with advocacy groups later noted that the victims' labor conditions reflected broader national patterns. Many Asian American women in the service industry occupy spaces that leave them vulnerable to misunderstanding and misrepresentation. Some workers in these settings face economic pressures that force long hours. Others rely on community networks to navigate employment that may not offer formal protections. These factors formed part of the broader analysis of why these specific locations may have been vulnerable to targeted violence. Community responses gained momentum throughout the day. Vigils emerged across Atlanta and other U.S. cities. Advocacy organizations issued statements emphasizing the connection between gendered violence, racialized harm, and the historical stereotypes that have shaped public perceptions of Asian-operated spas. Religious leaders, community organizers, and local officials spoke about the need to support the families of the victims. The events ignited broader conversations about labor exploitation, immigration, public safety, and the rising rates of anti-Asian hostility reported since early 2020. At the law enforcement level, investigators conducted extended interviews with individuals connected to the suspect. They aimed to understand his recent behavior, personal relationships, and state of mind leading up to the shootings. Some acquaintances reported that the suspect had sought treatment for issues he described as compulsive. Others noted that he appeared increasingly withdrawn. These accounts formed part of the investigative record, but were categorized as contextual information rather than definitive explanations. Forensic labs completed their analysis of the ballistic evidence later that week. They confirmed that all shell casings recovered from the three spa locations were fired from the same firearm. This result solidified the conclusion that the shootings represented a continuous sequence. Additional analysis of DNA evidence, collected from physical items at the scenes, further supported the linkage among the sites. Though processing DNA required more time, early indicators reinforced the emerging profile of a single suspect acting alone. Investigators also examined physical evidence such as footwear impressions, though the small interiors of the spas made this work challenging. Many prints overlapped. Workers, customers, and first responders left numerous tracks. Still, analysts identified some impressions that matched the shoes the suspect wore at the time of his arrest. This connection, while circumstantial, contributed to the overarching evidentiary framework. Interview dynamics shifted as investigators confronted the suspect with the accumulation of evidence. They asked specific questions about his movement between the spas. They sought clarifications regarding his stated rationale. They addressed inconsistencies. Throughout the interviews, investigators maintained a neutral tone, adhering to established protocols for violent crime questioning. The suspect continued to frame the shootings as a response to his internal struggle, though investigators noted that he did not provide a clear explanation for the decision to target these specific locations on that specific day. The investigation's midpoint raised a crucial interpretive question. It became necessary to distinguish between the suspect's personal statements and the broader structural context in which the shootings occurred. Scholars emphasize that individual intent cannot be separated from historical patterns of racialized and gendered violence. They argued that the spas existed within a framework of public stereotypes that placed Asian women at the intersection of vulnerability and hypersexualization. These discussions did not constitute part of the official evidence, but informed how the public and academic communities understood the event. Law enforcement documented the emergence of public demonstrations across the country. Large cities held gatherings to honor the victims and condemn racial and gender-based violence. Community leaders highlighted that the shootings occurred during a period of heightened anti-Asian hostility that had been reported since early 2020. Scholars argued that the suspect's actions cannot be fully analyzed without considering the climate of racialized fear and scapegoating that developed during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic. As investigators worked, digital forensics revealed additional details about the suspect's travel on the day of the shootings. Location data from his mobile device placed him near the first spa shortly before the attack. Subsequent data points confirmed his presence near the second and third locations at times that aligned with call logs. These findings strengthened the timeline reconstruction and confirmed that the suspect's account of his movements did not fully match the evidence. The location data contradicted some claims he made during his interviews. Investigators noted these discrepancies carefully. The next significant development emerged from an examination of receipts and financial records. A review of the suspect's bank transactions indicated previous visits to similar businesses, though not necessarily the spas targeted on March 16th. Investigators treated this information cautiously. They recognized that prior visits did not inherently indicate motive. Still, these records provided context regarding the suspect's familiarity with the general type of business he targeted. This information contributed to the broader understanding of the environment in which the violence occurred. As the day progressed, the investigative focus expanded to include national-level analysis of similar crimes. Specialists in hate crimes and gender-based violence provided consultation on the complexities of distinguishing between personal pathology and structural bias. They emphasized that the suspect's framing of his actions as related to temptation mirrored long-standing cultural narratives that objectify Asian women and position them as sources of moral or sexual danger. These experts argued that such narratives historically justified violence against minority women by shifting responsibility away from perpetrators. Though these analyses were external to the official investigation, they shaped public discourse and later influenced the legal strategies discussed in Chapter 3. In the days following the shootings, investigators compiled a comprehensive overview of the victims. They documented their migration histories, family structures, employment patterns, and community connections. These profiles deepened public understanding of the human toll of the event. They also highlighted structural vulnerabilities faced by workers in service industries, particularly those who are immigrants, women, or members of racially marginalized communities. These vulnerabilities informed scholarly discussions about the societal conditions that make certain workplaces more susceptible to violence. The victim profiles also revealed rich personal histories that challenged reductive stereotypes. Some victims were mothers supporting families across continents. Others were long-standing community members who contributed significantly to local networks. Several were primary income providers for their households. Their stories provided a counter-narrative to the objectifying assumptions that had long circulated about Asian-operated spas. This deeper understanding of who the victims were became a central feature of the public memorialization efforts that followed. By the end of the week, investigators had assembled a coherent timeline supported by forensic evidence, digital data, witness accounts, and physical artifacts. The timeline demonstrated that the suspect moved between the three spas in a planned sequence. His actions did not appear spontaneous. He followed a defined route and executed the shootings with rapid, patterned movements. These findings contradicted any suggestion that the attacks were impulsive or unconnected. With the core investigative work completed, the case transitioned from evidence gathering to legal assessment. Prosecutors in Cherokee County and Fulton County began reviewing the documented evidence to determine charges and potential sentencing frameworks. They also prepared to address questions related to hate crime statutes, a topic that would become central to the legal debates outlined in Chapter 3. As Chapter 2 closes, the investigation stands at a critical juncture. The forensic record is clear. The suspect's path has been reconstructed. The victims' lives have been honored through detailed profiles. The investigative narrative has shifted from immediate crisis management to the broader interpretive questions that would shape the legal and social aftermath. The central inquiry now turns toward the judicial arena, where the meaning of the shootings will be debated in terms of law, motive, structural harm, and societal responsibility. Chapter 3, Legal Framing, Structural Questions, and the Aftermath. The legal phase of the Atlanta spa shootings began in earnest as prosecutors from Cherokee County and Fulton County conducted parallel assessments of the accumulated evidence. Each county held jurisdiction over separate crime scenes, and each would pursue charges within its legal framework. What unfolded in the months after March 2021 demonstrated how the same sequence of events can be interpreted through different statutory lenses. The contrast between the two counties reflected broader national debates on race, gender, hate crime classification, and the boundaries of criminal accountability. Cherokee County moved quickly. Prosecutors reviewed ballistic results, witness statements, surveillance footage, and the suspect's interviews. They concluded that the evidence supported charges for multiple counts of murder. Defense attorneys signaled early that the suspect intended to plead guilty in that jurisdiction. After several procedural hearings, the court accepted the plea. In a decisive ruling, the judge sentenced the suspect to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for the four killings that occurred in Cherokee County. The decision ensured permanent incarceration while allowing the remaining charges in Fulton County to proceed. Fulton County took a different approach. The district attorney announced that the office would pursue the death penalty. The prosecutors also filed a notice that they intended to seek hate crime sentence enhancements. Their argument rested on the intersection of gender and racial targeting. They emphasized that 6 of the 8 victims were women of Asian descent, and that the shooting locations held cultural significance shaped by stereotypes surrounding Asian women and spa labor. The prosecutors asserted that these structural factors formed a meaningful framework for understanding motive, even if the suspect denied racial intent. The decision to pursue hate crime enhancements sparked immediate national scrutiny. Scholars in fields such as gender studies, ethnic studies, and criminology presented analyses that examined the historical context of violence against Asian and Asian American women. They pointed to the hypersexualization and stereotyping of Asian women in American culture, the history of restrictive labor options for immigrant women, and the documented rise in anti-Asian hostility during the COVID-19 pandemic. These scholars argued that the killings could not be understood outside the larger context of racialized misogyny. The prosecutor's argument aligned with this scholarly perspective, though they were bound to statutory definitions rather than theoretical frameworks. Public debate intensified as legal motions progressed. Community organizations expressed broad support for recognizing the role of race and gender in the shootings. At the same time, civil rights scholars cautioned against an over-reliance on hate crime statutes, arguing that they can create narrow legal definitions that obscure structural harm. They noted that hate crime laws require proof of motive at an individual level, while many forms of racial and gendered violence operate through systemic, cultural, or institutional mechanisms that exceed any single individual's stated intention. In the courtroom, prosecutors presented evidence that suggested the suspect chose the spas because of the racial composition of the workers and the social meanings attached to these businesses. They argued that the suspect's own statements regarding temptation revealed a framework that positioned Asian women as objects of moral danger. This framework, they asserted, reflected long-standing racialized narratives. Defense attorneys countered that the suspect's actions stemmed solely from his alleged addiction and that he did not target the victims because of their ethnicity. They emphasized that 2 of the victims were not Asian and argued that this undermined the prosecution's theory. These arguments highlighted a central tension. Legal systems require specific forms of proof, while the structural contexts that shape violence often fall outside narrow evidentiary categories. The hearings made clear that the case was not only about the actions of a single individual, but also about the framework society uses to interpret acts of violence that disproportionately harm marginalized groups. As the legal proceedings continued, community responses evolved. Vigils expanded into organized events focused on public education. Advocacy groups held forums on anti-Asian harassment, gendered labor precarity, and the historical roots of contemporary stereotypes. Legal aid organizations supported the victims' families with immigration matters, language translation, and financial assistance. Universities hosted panels examining the shootings within broader scholarly debates on racial capitalism, labor exploitation, and gendered violence. These events formed a civic and academic archive that helped contextualize the killings beyond the immediate moment of crisis. Public officials at local, state, and national levels acknowledged the tragedy in official statements. Some highlighted the need for stronger hate crime statutes. Others emphasized community safety and support for immigrant workers. Discussions also emerged regarding labor protections for spa workers, though policy recommendations varied widely. Some advocated for stronger oversight and regulation. Others argued for protections that centered on workers' safety, rights, and economic stability without perpetuating stigmas associated with their occupations. As the case moved through the courts, academic researchers published analyses that sought to map the shootings onto broader patterns of violence. One line of research examined the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on racialized scapegoating. Another explored the vulnerabilities faced by immigrant women in service industries. Scholars pointed out that many Asian women in these sectors face linguistic barriers, limited employment opportunities, and exposure to customer bias. These vulnerabilities exist within a societal framework that often sexualizes Asian women and misrepresents their labor. Researchers argued that the convergence of these factors shaped the conditions under which the shootings occurred. Legal scholars contributed additional insights. Some focused on the challenges of proving hate crime enhancements when perpetrators deny racial or gender-based motives. Others analyzed the history of hate crime legislation and noted that statutes often reflect political compromise more than comprehensive recognition of structural harm. They emphasized that hate crime laws require prosecutors to demonstrate explicit bias, even though implicit bias, systemic patterns, and cultural narratives also produce discriminatory outcomes. These analyses did not diminish the brutality of the shootings, but placed them within a larger debate about how the legal system conceptualizes and responds to identity-based violence. Meanwhile, the families of the victims continued to navigate the complexities of grief, legal proceedings, and public attention. Many members of the Asian American community felt a renewed sense of vulnerability. Community centers and advocacy groups reported increases in requests for safety resources and mental health support. The shootings became a symbol of the broader climate of fear experienced by many Asian American residents during the early years of the pandemic. As the hate crime proceedings advanced, prosecutors in Fulton County highlighted evidence that suggested intentionality beyond the suspect's stated rationale. They referenced his familiarity with the general type of business, his deliberate sequencing of the attacks, and the demographic composition of the victims. They acknowledged that the suspect did not issue explicit racial statements, but they argued that his actions were shaped by a cultural and ideological framework that positioned Asian women as targets. The legal debate centered on whether this framework constituted bias motivation under statutory definitions. Defense attorneys challenged these interpretations. They argued that academic theories of racialized misogyny cannot serve as evidence in court. They maintained that the suspect acted in response to his personal struggle and that the choice of spas reflected only his own patterns of behavior, not racial hostility. They cautioned against what they described as overreach in applying hate crime enhancements. This tension underscored the difference between legal reasoning, which focuses on individual culpability, and scholarly reasoning, which examines structural forces. As motions were argued, the broader public continued to engage with the case. Media outlets reported on each development. Advocacy groups emphasized the need to support victims' families and to confront racialized violence in all forms. Community forums discussed the intersection of labor, migration, and vulnerability. Many speakers noted that immigrant women in service industries often face social invisibility, which can influence both how violence occurs and how it is interpreted. Eventually, the legal proceedings in Fulton County moved toward trial. The prosecution prepared to present evidence supporting the hate crime enhancements. The defense prepared to challenge the statutory applicability. Before the trial could begin, however, extended pretrial litigation and procedural issues delayed the process. These delays left many community members and scholars concerned that the broader issues raised by the case might lose momentum in public discourse. Advocacy organizations worked to maintain attention on the structural factors that contributed to the shootings. During this period, scholars emphasized that the aftermath of the Atlanta spa shootings should not be understood solely through legal outcomes. They argued that the killings illuminated long-standing systemic issues, including the undervaluation of immigrant labor, the invisibility of service industry workers, and the racialized narratives that shape public understanding. They pointed out that the victims' lives reflected resilience, community connection, and dedication to family. Honoring these aspects of their identities was essential for understanding the full impact of the tragedy. As months passed, community coalitions developed programs focused on improving safety for immigrant workers. Some organizations provided legal workshops. Others offered English language classes, counseling, and public safety training. Academic institutions facilitated research collaborations aimed at documenting the experiences of Asian American women in service sectors. These initiatives formed part of a broader effort to transform grief into public engagement and structural change. The families of the victims participated in memorial events and cultural ceremonies that honored their loved ones. These events drew large crowds and included prayers, readings, and reflections. Local officials attended, emphasizing the responsibility of the wider community to confront racialized and gendered violence. The ceremonies created spaces for mourning and solidarity. They also served as reminders that the shootings had effects that extended far beyond the immediate crime scenes. As the legal processes continued, the case became a touchstone for national conversations about violence, identity, and accountability. Commentators noted that the shootings forced many Americans to confront uncomfortable questions. How should society interpret violence that disproportionately impacts marginalized groups? What frameworks appropriately capture the intersection of individual actions and structural forces? How do laws reflect or obscure the realities of racial and gendered harm? These questions did not have simple answers, but they formed the core of the discourse surrounding the aftermath of the shootings. In the final assessment, the Atlanta spa shootings occupy a significant place in contemporary analyses of violence and discrimination in the United States. The events revealed the complex interplay between individual behavior and societal narratives. They highlighted the vulnerabilities faced by immigrant women in service industries. They demonstrated the challenges of prosecuting crimes that exist at the intersection of race, gender, and labor. They sparked scholarly, legal, and community engagement that continues to inform discussions of structural inequity. As this chapter closes, the broader question remains: how should society respond to acts of violence that emerge from both personal decisions and systemic conditions? The legal system addresses individual culpability, but the deeper structural issues require collective, long-term engagement. The Atlanta spa shootings underscore the need for such engagement and leave behind a lasting call for accountability, recognition, and meaningful change.